Dr. Edwin Thorpe planned to recruit 440 pregnant women to determine the treatment-limiting toxicities of four HIV drugs in pregnant women. "It's an embarrassment to me, to my family, and particularly to my deceased aunt and godmother, that NIH's Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development was a collaborator in this fraud." Hafford was healthy and symptom-free. None of her subsequent tests ever showed any clinical markers for AIDS, and Dr. Thorpe never told Hafford that the HIV test measured only for the presence of antibodies and was not a reliable indicator of HIV infection. Furthermore, pregnancy frequently triggers false positive results on HIV antibody tests, and Dr. Thorpe tested Hafford only once. To make matters worse, her family later found out that Joyce never signed her consent form, suggesting that Dr. Thorpe never informed her of nevirapine's risks. Hafford's health took a steep nosedive after her first dose of nevirapine. It only took a few days before Hafford was showing undeniable signs of dwindling liver function. Instead of taking her off the drugs that he knew could be deadly, Dr. Thorpe prescribed cortisone cream for her skin rashes. Within weeks, Hafford was presenting with alarming signals of hepatic collapse. 41 days after starting the trial, she was dead from liver failure, the same injury about which both FDA and JAMA had issued clear warnings. On July 29th, doctors delivered her baby, Sterling, by C-section 3 days before Joyce died. When the shattered family gathered around her body, Dr. Thorpe and his team told them, to their bewilderment, that Joyce had died of rapidly progressed AIDS. They were lying. The year after her passing, Associated Press reporter John Solomon gave Joyce's family a trove of DAIDS reports he had obtained from a Freedom of Information Act request. In those internal memos, DAIDS officials openly acknowledged to one another that nevirapine caused Joyce Hafford's liver to fail. Dr. Thorpe and his colleagues kept Sterling on AZT for 3 months. 15 months later, Sterling tested negative for HIV. Despite their repeated requests, Dr. Thorpe and his hospital refused to release Sterling's medical records to the Haffords. Sterling's family believes that NIAID withheld those records because they would prove that neither Joyce nor Sterling ever had HIV. All babies born to mothers with HIV test positive at birth, and almost all babies shed the maternal antibodies by 18 months. Celia Farber, who focused her Harper's expose on Joyce's death and the HIV-NET cover-up, is still angry. Farber, who grew close to the Hafford family during the months she spent researching nevirapine, blames Dr. Fauci directly. "The death of Joyce Ann Hafford in Memphis was a methodical, calculated homicide of a black woman by Fauci's henchmen," Farber told me. "They had to know they were killing her when they saw her go into jaundice, and they just watched her liver crash. They wouldn't let her off the nevirapine. It seemed like very clear medical murder at Dr. Fauci's doorstep. I'm still trying to recover from it." At that time, Dr. Jonathan M. Fishbein, M.D., was DAID's first director of the Office for Policy and Clinical Research Operations. His job was to monitor and enforce compliance to federal research and ethical policy in DAIDS-sponsored studies. In the summer of 2003, he intervened in Hafford's case. According to Dr. Fishbein, DAID's medical staff always knew that Hafford died of nevirapine toxicity. "Nevirapine's toxicity," Dr. Fishbein told me, "particularly its association with liver failure, was well documented, and the PI certainly had that knowledge." That August, Dr. Fishbein sent a memo to Dr. Fauci's AIDS branch director, Ed Tremont, informing him that nevirapine caused Hafford's lethal liver failure. Tremont wrote back, "Ouch, not much we can do about dumb docs." Tremont's glib riposte seems to have been like a subtle signal to Dr. Fishbein to get in line with NIAID's strategic cover-up. Dr. Fishbein told me that acknowledging Navarapin's role in Hefford's death would have jeopardized Navarapin's FDA approval. Despite Tremont's crass cipher, Dr. Fishbein's regulatory team nevertheless informed the FDA about Hefford's drug-related death. Hefford was not the only trial recruit to suffer. In the initial Phase 1 trial on 21 pregnant women, NIAID's investigators would later report that 4 of 22 infants died and 12 suffered serious adverse events. Furthermore, the studies suggested that Navarapin was ineffective. None of the women experienced reduction of viral loads. When Thorpe and his colleagues finally published the results of their Navarapin study in 2004, they acknowledged that the study was suspended because of greater than expected toxicity. Rooting out integrity in the workplace. Dr. Fishbein didn't last long in his official capacity as the DAIDS official in charge of enforcing compliance with clinical research and ethical policy. His lethal misstep was his decision to follow a trail of irregularities affecting a NIAID drug trial called Esprit, which tested interleukin-2, IL-2, a cancer chemotherapy and AIDS drug known by its brand name Proleukin. The Esprit study was investigating IL-2 clinical outcomes in individuals with asymptomatic HIV+. In December 2003, the Esprit medical officer alerted Dr. Fishbein to troubling side effects in the Proleukin trial, namely capillary leak and an unusual psychiatric side effect, suicidal ideation. The medical officer, Larry Fox, worried that NIAID was putting volunteers in danger by withholding the information about those hazards from the investigator brochure as the law required. This brochure is an FDA-mandated document containing updated information detailing, among other things, the side effects and risks of an investigational drug. It provides clinical trial investigators with safety information compiled across study sites to keep study subjects informed about emerging hazards. Furthermore, without an up-to-date document, NIAID had issued the last one in 2000, NIAID was not adequately warning potential clinical trial enrollees about these serious dangers. Recalls Dr. Fishbein, the drug had grave risks for suicidal ideation and capillary leaks. The study leadership was ignoring their legal duty to inform the study recruits and participants about these troubling signals. By this time, NIAID had invested some $36 million in Esprit and had thousands of subjects enrolled at 200 international locations over nearly 4 years. If these asymptomatic participants were to learn about the emerging risks, NIAID feared they would drop out. It would also be difficult to attract new volunteers. The failure to retain subjects or recruit additional volunteers would nullify the study, one of NIAID's most costly ever. Ironically, after 8 years and 4,150 subjects, Esprit concluded Proleukin offered no benefits to clinical outcome in HIV+ patients. It was now evident to key NIAID officials that Dr. Fishbein was becoming an all-around nuisance. He was professional, curious, incorruptible, and far too serious about performing his duties. His big problem, says Farber, is that he thought his job was legit. Dr. Fishbein's personal virtues were all fatal character flaws within the NIAID institutional culture. Dr. Fishbein's refusal to toe the line sent him stumbling into the terminal career cul-de-sac at NIAID. Dr. Fishbein explained further about the Proleukin trial. It was a serious violation of protocols, and the researchers were ignoring their legal duty to report the signal. They omitted and whitewashed all these safety problems. You can't just focus on efficacy and ignore safety. Dr. Fishbein told AP reporter John Solomon, the ones that were in the study and those that wanted to get in the study, neither were being informed. NIAID feared that if they understood the risks, they would drop out. Dr. Fishbein had entered a dangerous realm at NIAID. He was interfering with ongoing drug approvals. Tremont was angry that Dr. Fishbein was allowing concerns about patient safety to become an obstacle to the agency's central mission of getting new drugs through the approval process with positive reviews. Tremont warned Dr. Fishbein to slow down. "You are moving too fast. You need to get to know how this place works," Tremont told him. "We need to act more like a pharmaceutical company. We need to get patients and get studies done." In the course of his IL-2 investigation, Dr. Fishbein stumbled on another awkward fact. Anthony Fauci personally owned patents to IL-2 and stood to make millions in royalties if the treatment won FDA approval. Dr. Fishbein was shocked. Dr. Fauci had a personal financial interest in the drug being tested. He was listed as a co-owner on the patent for Proleukin and stood to earn royalties from it. According to little-known HHS rules at that time, NIH employees could collect unlimited royalty payments from drugs they worked on during their agency tenures. Dr. Fishbein found it stunning that Dr. Fauci stood to personally gain significant revenues, providing HHS green-lighted Proleukin. Contemporaneous records obtained by the AP found that some 51 NIH scientists were then involved in testing products for which they secretly receive royalties. Dr. Fauci and his trusty longtime sidekick, Dr. H. Clifford Lane, have received tens of thousands of dollars in royalties for an experimental AIDS treatment they invented, interleukin-2. At the same time, their office has spent millions in tax dollars to test the treatment on patients across the globe. The AP story expressed understandable indignation about the circumstances under which the government has licensed the commercial rights to IL-2 to Chiron Corp. Fauci's division subsequently has spent $36 million in taxpayer money testing the treatment on patients in one experiment alone. Known as the Esprit experiment, it is one of the largest AIDS research projects in NIH history, testing IL-2 on patients at more than 200 sites in 18 countries over the last 5 years. On February 6, 2004, Dr. Fishbein wrote the study executive committee requesting issuance of the long-overdue updated version of the investigator brochure within 60 days to include warnings of the newly discovered risks. Within days, Dr. Fishbein recalled, "I wrote a letter to the executive committee telling them to update the brochure. From that point on, the floor came out below me." Even though his mandate was to enforce research policy, Dr. Fishbein had crossed the red line at NIAID. He was not just interfering with the drug approval process, he was meddling with research in which Fauci had a peculiar interest. Dr. Fishbein's questioning about Dr. Fauci's patents tripped NIH into DEFCON 1. "All sorts of alarms went off," recalls Dr. Fishbein. "I came into government very naive. At the very least, I assumed that since Dr. Fauci wanted me to make sure studies were properly done, safety came first and that the participants were protected," he laughed. "I was wrong." He recounts that he had met Dr. Fauci only once, at the interview when Dr. Fauci hired him as NIAID's Chief Ethical and Regulatory Compliance Officer. Dr. Fishbein recalls Dr. Fauci's earnestness. "This is an important job," he said. If you come across any problems in the agency, I want to hear about them personally. I want you to come directly to me." Dr. Fauci told Dr. Fishbein that his door would always be open. But when Dr. Fishbein asked to meet with him about the IL-2 trials, Dr. Fauci went dark, and Dr. Fishbein felt the institution turning against him. "His guardian said he'd get back to me," recalls Fishbein. "He didn't." He adds, "He basically ran away." In the course of his subsequent grievance procedures and litigation over his firing, Dr. Fishbein obtained emails and other documents that chronicled what happened behind the scenes. Dr. Fauci's principal strategy in discussions with his upper-level management was how to sack Dr. Fishbein while keeping NIAID's director out of the splatter zone when things exploded. On February 24, 2004, Dr. Fauci met with Kagan and Tremont to plan strategies for ridding himself of Dr. Fishbein. The men hatched a plan by which Kagan and Tremont would orchestrate Dr. Fishbein's dismissal while making Dr. Fauci's fingerprints undetectable. The challenge was daunting. All the players knew that Dr. Fauci was the only one with legal authority to fire Dr. Fishbein. NIAID human resources officers originally told Dr. Fishbein that Dr. Fauci had authorized his firing. Dr. Fauci later protested to various investigators from NIH and the U.S. Congress that he had not ordered the firing. The NIH also denied that Dr. Fauci had ordered the firing. Dr. Fishbein calls this statement a lie. "I was a Title 42 special expert, paid outside the agency budget. Dr. Fauci was the only NIAID officer with authority to fire me." Dr. Fishbein's reputation, his integrity, and his sterling work record presented additional obstacles. In November 2003, 3 months before his dismissal, Dr. Fauci presented Dr. Fishbein with a commendation for exceptional work at NIAID. 3 months later, on February 9, 2004, Dr. Tremont also recognized Dr. Fishbein's outstanding job performance by recommending him to receive a $2,500 Service Recognition Award. 5 days later, on February 13, 2004, Kagan blocked the processing of the award and canceled the $2,500 merit prize. DAIDS officials followed these actions with an exchange of frantic emails discussing how to axe Dr. Fishbein without implicating Fauci. In a February 23, 2004 note to Kagan, Tremont said, "John, let's start working on this. Tony, Fauci, will not want anything to come back on us, so we are going to have ironclad documentation. No sense of harassment or unfairness, and, like other personnel actions, this is going to take some work. In Clausewitzian style, we must overwhelm with force. We will prepare our paperwork, then go from there." Several of Dr. Fauci's other trusted subordinates joined the email chain with recommendations for how to blow up Dr. Fishbein's career while keeping Dr. Fauci's hands clean. Said Farber, "Jonathan Fishbein was tarred and feathered for pointing out that the NIH flagship study on Nevirapine was a complete disaster. Fishbein's failure to fall into line, his failure to understand that Nevirapine was too important to fail, meant that the AIDS bureaucracy's neutralizing antibodies had to be activated to destroy him." Between February 14th through 18th, after Tremont notified Dr. Fishbein that he was now reporting to Kagan, the same man whom he had recently cited for disciplinary action, Dr. Fishbein exchanged emails with Tremont, then traveling in Thailand, requesting an explanation for this odd demotion that had him working for a lower-level employee who was a key target of his misconduct investigation. An elusive Tremont refused to explain the decision and answered with a vague remonstration reminiscent of Dr. Fauci's signature obfuscating gobbledygook. It has not been lost on me that the most complaints about Kagan I heard from our constituents when I arrived revolved around complaints filed by Dr. Fishbein's branch, and since you have arrived, I have not heard a single complaint, and when I have inquired about that, the answer has been the charge brought by you. On February 25, 2004, Kagan canned Dr. Fishbein. Kagan explained to Dr. Fishbein that he had failed in every aspect of his job and that his bosses saw no chance for improvement. Kagan advised Dr. Fishbein to leave DAIDS immediately. Dr. Fishbein opted to stay and fight his dismissal. Dr. Fishbein first wrote to Tremont and Dr. Fauci requesting a meeting. He never received a reply. He next appealed to Dr. Fauci's ostensible boss, NIH Director Elias Zerhouni, who likewise refused to meet with him. NIH banned all employees from speaking about or to Dr. Fishbein. "Everyone was terrified of Fauci," says Dr. Fishbein. "He runs the agency like a vindictive dictator. Everyone is frightened of him. Everyone knows that you never cross Fauci." In Farber's words, Fishbein became a ghost. Nobody addressed him in the corridors, in the elevators, in the cafeteria. "There was an active campaign to humiliate me," he recalls. "It was as if I had AIDS in the early days. I was like Tom Hanks in Philadelphia. Nobody would come near me." On February 26, 2004, Dr. Fishbein met with NIH's Office of Management Assessment, OMA, to complain about the actions against him. OMA also declined to investigate. On March 1, 2004, Dr. Fishbein brought his charges to the HHS Inspector General. The IG similarly refused to lift the carpet at NIH. Later that month, in desperation, Dr. Fishbein moved for whistleblower protection and sought a congressional investigation of the wide-ranging corruption at NIAID. On Capitol Hill, he at last found sympathetic ears. Dr. Fishbein told investigators for United States Senator Charles E. Grassley, Republican, Iowa, and Senator Max Baucus, Democrat, Montana, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee and ranking minority member, respectively, that his sacking was retribution for his reports of wrongdoing in the Nevarapin and Proleukin trials. Both senators began clamoring for HHS to investigate Dr. Fauci's corruption charges against NIAID and to answer the troubling questions Dr. Fishbein had raised about the homicidal studies in Tennessee and Uganda and sexual harassment and mismanagement in NIAID's home office. In a series of stern letters to NIH Director Zerhouni and his boss, HHS Secretary Michael Levitt, Senators Arlen Specter and Herb Cole joined Grassley and Baucus in rebuking NIH for inaction on Dr. Fishbein's complaints. Maryland Congresspersons Representatives Ben Cardin, Barbara Mikulski, and Steny Hoyer signed a similar letter. It's illustrative of Dr. Fauci's overwhelming power that he and his bosses decided to ignore and defy these remonstrances. After all, these three representatives were the royalty of NIH's home state delegation. In May 2004, under pressure from lawmakers, NIH agreed to commission an Institute of Medicine, IOM, investigation of HIV-NET-012. The Institute of Medicine, a branch of the National Academies of Sciences, is ostensibly Congress's independent and trustworthy advisor on scientific issues. IOM regularly assembles panels of top scientists to oversee and review agency science. The presumption is that while regulated industries easily capture and compromise federal agencies, the Institute of Medicine is incorruptible. IOM